prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host today, Dave Allen. Melody's taking care of other client business. Call us at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188 for all your physical gold and silver needs. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day, Thursday, May 11, 2023. But first, happy... what day would you like to celebrate today? It's National Eat Whatever You Want Day. I'm afraid a lot of us are on a restricted diet for good health reasons. It's also National Roll the Foam Day, of all things. I'd like to see their K Street offices in Washington. But me, I'm celebrating yes, Twilight Zone Day. Twilight Zone Day features the mysterious twists and turns of life that are sometimes highlighted with eerie background music. Do I hear Pink Floyd? And unexplainable occurrences. The television show The Twilight Zone was created, written, and narrated by Rod Serling, premiering as far back as October 1, 1959. Coincidentally, that happened to be the date that an adventurous three-year-old declared emancipation from his young mother and left him in his yard to go inside for some clothespins she had forgotten. About two minutes and a half block later, that audacious toddler started crossing the street to the local park that his grandma walked him to almost every day, yes, without looking both ways. Crunch. That would be the sound of a trash truck running over the left foot of that naughty little lad, whose short life had been spared for some reason with only a broken foot, one semi-detached toe, and a cast for probably 6 to 8 weeks. Well, that little lad happened to be me, and that was the first of what eventually be countless lifetime examples of a Twilight Zone moment. But that's a story for another time. Let's go to today's market report, shall we? In the precious metal markets, tough day. overall. We've got gold down in the New York spot aftermarket, down about 0.8% from a high of $2,041 to about $2,015 an ounce. Silver down, gosh, almost 5% from a high of $2,511 to its current $2,425. Platinum down 2%, $1,102. Palladium down a little less than 1% at $1,587. Now, bear with me here. Well, this is always embarrassing and frustrating when it happens. Here we go. That's some freezing on a computer. The U.S. dollar index was up about 0.6% today, 102.08. That explains some of the fall in these precious metals. Oil down 1.5%, $71.46 a barrel. Natural gas down 0.25%, 2.185. In the Treasury market, the bellwether 10-year yield down a couple basis points, yielding currently 3.38%. Both the 2-year and 10-year yields exceeding that. The 2-year yield at 3.9%. The 3-month 5.18. Amazing. That inverted yield curve, just crying out for a recession. In any event, in the paper markets, Dow Jones down 222 points, 33,000, we'll call it 310. NASDAQ actually up 22, 12,329, it rounds to, and the broader S&P 500 down 7 points at 4,131. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's DGS Coins Market Report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. On to today's news. First off, wholesale prices in the U.S. rose only slightly last month, the latest sign that inflationary pressures may be easing more than a year after the Fed unleashed its obsessive campaign of higher interest rates. From March to April, the government's producer price index, PPI, rose just 0.2% after falling 0.4% from February to March, held down by falling prices for food, transportation, and warehousing. And compared with the year earlier, wholesale prices rose just 2.3% on an annualized basis last month. That's the 10th straight slowdown and the lowest figure since January 2021. Lower energy prices helped slow the annualized inflation rate. The index that the Labor Department issued this morning reflects prices charged by manufacturers, farmers, and wholesalers. As we say, can provide an early sign of how fast consumer inflation is going to rise. Excluding the volatile food and energy prices, so-called core wholesale inflation rose 0.2% from March and 3.2% over the past year. Now, the Fed, for its own reason, pays particularly close attention to core prices, which don't obviously give a complete picture. But economists say they tend to be a better gauge of the economy's underlying inflation pressures. Follows yesterday's government report showing that at the consumer level, core prices rose 0.4% from March to April. And that was the 5th straight month that those prices have risen by at least that much, well above the pace needed to meet the Fed's 2% annual inflation target, even though their preferred metric is the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. On a year-to-year basis, overall consumer inflation at 4.9% has dropped significantly since peaking at over 9 in June last year. Yet, it remains well above the Fed's target. And added to that, economic growth slowed to a tepid 1.1% annual rate from January through March. Of course, the Fed has raised its benchmark interest rates 10 times in 14 months. And Fed policymakers want to slow the world's biggest economy to just enough to control these price increases without causing that dreaded recession. But many economists remain skeptical and expect the U.S. to slip into one later this year. Now, the job market, the cornerstone of the economy, remains healthy overall, even though it's recently lost some momentum. But last week, the Fed signaled that it may now pause interest rate hikes so that its policymakers can step back and assess the impact of higher rates on growth and inflation. Speaking of the job market, the hot jobs market has been defying the weakening economy and literally confounding officials at the Fed for months, but now it's showing signs of cooling. Latest set of employment data from the government show that job openings fell in March to their lowest level since April 2021. Layoffs rose to 1.8 million, their highest level since December 2020. Employers are also slowing the pace of hiring. While hiring remained strong in April, the government lowered its hiring figures for February and March. More broadly, job gains for February through April marked the weakest three-month average since January of 2021. The persistently strong labor market has bewildered the Fed and economists in general for more than a year as these higher interest rates to slow economic growth did little to loosen the historically tight job market with record low headline unemployment. That resistance is now slowly fading, according to more than one analyst. According to one big bank strategist, the labor market's usually the last to break in an economic downturn, and when it does, things can change quite rapidly. Factors include tighter business conditions, weak sentiment, declining job openings, and they'll likely keep factoring into future labor data. The experts concede the labor market can't dodge a downturn indefinitely. Now, the strong job market and higher wages for workers have largely resisted the Fed's efforts to cool inflation while also keeping a weakening economy from slipping into a full-fledged recession. The Fed's raised rates 10 times since last March, but recently signaled it may forego a rate hike at its next meeting in mid-June. Now, over 90% of CME future traders expect the Fed to hold its current benchmark interest rate steady at a range of 5 to 5.25% at that June 14th meeting. The Fed's goal when it began raising interest rates last year was to achieve that so-called soft landing. Earlier this month, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said such an outcome could be achieved, pointing out that headline unemployment has actually declined slightly since the Fed started hiking rates, even as inflation declined. But unemployment counting short-term discouraged workers is still close to 7%. Wall Street, of course, is closely watching how companies react to the coming slowdown. Analysts expect many of the layoffs announced over the past few months by companies like Amazon and Google and Facebook to have a lag effect on broader employment data later this year. And in a related story today, it's jobless claims Thursday. The number of Americans filing for jobless claims, first-time claims, last week rose to its highest level in a year and a half. The labor market again remains healthy by historical standards. applications for unemployment benefits for the week ending May 6 rose by 22,000 to 264,000, according to the Labor Department out with the report this morning. That's up 9% from the previous week's 242K and the highest number since November 2021. The weekly claims numbers are seen as a proxy of the number of initial U.S. layoffs. The four-week moving average of claims, which evens out some of the weekly volatility, rose by 6,000, 0.5%, to 245,250. And for the week of April 29th, the total number of Americans collecting unemployment rose by 12,000, or 7% total from the previous week, to 1.81 million. American workers, again, enjoying unusual job security despite rising interest rates and all the uncertainty and fears of a looming recession. Private non-farm employers added a healthy 250,000 jobs in April, according to the government. But while hiring was solid, it was much weaker in February and March than it had previously estimated. Job gains for those months was lowered by a combined 149,000 jobs, another possible sign that interest rate hikes are starting to affect the labor market. Until very recently, we know there was very little evidence that the Fed actions were working on the labor market. Last week, the Commerce Department reported that the economy slowed sharply in the first quarter as higher interest rates literally hammered the housing market and businesses reduced inventories. Of course, there have been an increasing number of layoffs recently, mostly in the tech sector, where companies added jobs at a furious pace during the pandemic. But it's not just the tech sector. You know, IBM, Microsoft, Salesforce, Twitter, Lyft, DoorDash, Amazon, Facebook, McDonald's, Morgan Stanley, and 3M have also announced big layoffs recently. So let's keep following those numbers. And last this segment, our friends across the Atlantic, the Bank of England, raised interest rates today to their highest level since late 2008. As it continues to combat stubbornly high inflation in the UK. Today's decision by the BOE's 9-member Monetary Policy Committee to lift its main interest rate by another 25 basis points to 4.5% was widely anticipated in the financial markets. The BOE increase was its 12th in a row. Just two members on the panel voted to keep rates unchanged. Now, like other central banks around the world, the Bank of England has sought to keep a lid on inflation, which over there, over the past year, has been fueled largely by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That, of course, sent energy prices soaring, a development that then led to price increases across just a broad array of goods and services. The BOE started raising interest rates in late 2021 from a low of just 0.1% to keep a lid on price rises that were first largely stoked by bottlenecks resulting from the lifting of lockdown restrictions, supply chain issues, and again, subsequently by Russia's war. The BOE, which is tasked like the Fed with keeping inflation at around 2%, said that inflation would likely fall by one half from current levels to around 5% by the end of this year. No experts say the energy price backdrop will help lower inflation. The BOE said food prices have stayed higher for longer than expected, partly because of the war in Ukraine and resulting poor harvests in Ukraine and other countries. As a result, it said inflation is expected to decline less rapidly this year than it previously thought. So today's interest rate hike will obviously pile more pressure on borrowers, particularly those who have mortgages that track the bank's headline rate. Unlike the U.S., where many homeowners fix their mortgage rates for 30 years. The prevailing habit in the UK is to fix a rate for much shorter periods of time, at which time they move to their lender's usually higher variable rate or just seek out other deals. Hey, I hear that music. It means it's time for a short break. I hope you'll stick around. We'll be back after these important messages. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE talkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you, never gonna make you cry, never gonna say goodbye, never gonna tell a lie and hurt you.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody, taking care of other business for all your gold and silver needs. Call us at 1-800-375-4188 or check out our website, dgscoins.com. While you're there, sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs. Again, dgscoins.com. Boy, I'm glad our programs, right now anyway, are audio only, especially when the music's playing. Protect the innocent from our rhythmic challenged, what do you call it, head bopping? It's good stuff, isn't it? Hey, it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. And speaking of the Twilight Zone, tipping practices. They've changed quickly since the onset of the pandemic, and the next area of change appears to be tipping in, listen to this, self-checkout lines. Yes, self-checkout lines. Customers these days, in the U.S. anyway, are now being prompted to leave tips in self-checkout lines at airports, grocery stores, stadiums, cafes. And it's leaving customers unsure who exactly their generosity will benefit. It's according to a study by the Wall Street Journal. Jars for tips and self-checkout lines are an example of tip creep. That's a phenomenon that's seen companies prompting customers to leave more sizable tips in more transactional situations since the onset of COVID. At the beginning of the pandemic, a number of Americans embraced the early movement to increase the size of tips to especially service workers. It was a nod to the direness of their financial situations and a thanks, really, for taking on the risk of working to provide essential services throughout the pandemic. Adherence to that line of thinking sought to make a 20% tip the minimum and tipped in an increasingly wide range of situations. Those tips, however, were assumed to be going to everyday workers, people who would stand to benefit significantly from them. And self-tipping is, to some, a different proposition. Garrett Bemiller said that the prompt to tip in a self-checkout situation feels like emotional blackmail, a means of guilt-tripping customers into tipping even when they ordinarily wouldn't. Companies and organizations that the Journal reached out to largely said that tipping is completely optional and that tips at self-checkout stations are split between staff members. Nevertheless, some customers aren't happy about companies prompting of tips from them. For some, the situation is made more complicated by a compensation structure for a lot of service workers, take restaurant employees as one example, who are often not paid a living hourly wage and then have to rely on tips to make the money they need to support themselves and their families. The situation is also further complicated by the fact that some company managers and owners actually steal tips from their workers. Now, these rapid changes in tipping practices over the last several years have prompted a broader conversation about of tipping in the first place and how it has long been billed as an extra optional part of a transaction functions in the operation of certain businesses. Myself, when I first encountered a tipping jar a few years ago at a takeout-only joint, I thought to myself, well, that's pretty ballsy. But when I thought about it more, I realized that, well, there are some workers, especially at restaurants, who would normally benefit from a tip, if I were dining in, who were still doing the kind of work that I was getting something out of with my takeout dinner. Plus, again, especially restaurant workers took some level of risk by showing up for work during the bulk of the pandemic after life began opening up again. For example, I think of line cooks, dishwashers, and servers who significantly contribute to a takeout meal, even if, say, servers have to do less service to their takeout customers. So I still tip 5 to 10% for takeouts, depending on the type and size of my order, you know, like a slice of pizza versus four Chinese takeout orders. But like many Americans, I've drawn the line at self-serve checkouts. Yes, I do sometimes wonder if the person who's directing me to the next available counter is struggling to make ends meet. But to encourage customers to leave a gratuity for what in most instances is a 1 second or two encounter, I just don't think that's right of the store. Bottom line, if companies paid some of their employees better, we wouldn't be going down this road. And that is this week's Levity is Golden. Turning to politics, some observers are saying that hardliners are wavering on the debt ceiling as lawmakers embrace negotiating the less toxic elements, like clawing back unspent pandemic aid from a few years ago on the GOP's laundry list of demanded budget cuts. It is a signal of bipartisan coalescence after a months-long stalemate between the two parties that heightened concerns about a default on U.S. debt. President Biden, after meeting with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and other congressional leaders yesterday, said he would take a hard look at pandemic aid. He said, "We don't need it all, but the question is what obligations were made. It's on the table." And Biden and McCarthy otherwise indicated neither had moved away from their respective positions. Biden is expected to meet again with the leaders tomorrow as their staffs continue meeting in the interim. Some Democrats are saying they would like to see the White House receptive posture to negotiations with McCarthy and accept that some concessions will have to be made. One of them, Representative Henry Cuellar of Texas, said, I prefer a clean debt ceiling increase, but at the end of the day, we probably have to sit down and work something out. Congressman Susan Wild of Pennsylvania noted, I understand the administration's original position about not wanting to negotiate. But Representative Jared Moskowitz of Florida said, this is headed toward a negotiation. Republican Congressman Nick LaLota pointed to COVID aid as the low-hanging fruit for House Democrats to move more toward the Republicans. Representative Angie Craig, a Democrat from Minnesota, said, there's a lot of stuff on the table. We should be talking about reclaiming unused COVID funds and discussions about discretionary spending. But some Democrats are wary of anything other than a clean debt ceiling increase. Democratic Massachusetts Rep. Jim McGovern believes the Republicans should stop giving us ransom notes and just the debt ceiling. His colleague Jared Huffman of California added, the next steps are, I think, to try to decouple these budget conversations from the threat of default. Politics of passing a watered-down version of the GOP House bill could be tricky for McCarthy, especially with the House Freedom Caucus empowered to dislodge him as Speaker. Representative Don Bacon of Nebraska said, you're going to get 218 votes with a mix of Republicans and Democrats. You may lose some on both wings. Bacon acknowledged that scenario carries significant risk for McCarthy, but you can't let a small group of people dictate your life. Easy for you to say, Congressman. We'll see where this goes. Across seas, President Volodymyr Zelensky said remarks that were broadcast today that Ukraine is delaying its long-awaited counteroffensive against Russia's occupying forces because it lacks enough Western weapons to succeed without suffering too many casualties. His remarks were aired shortly before the UK announced it has sent Ukraine air-launched cruise missiles that would allow pilots to extend their reach farther than possibly any other weapon in their arsenal to locations deep behind the front line. The Ukrainian counteroffensive against Russia's more than 14-month-old invasion now has been expected as winter has turned to spring, and Zelensky said in an interview that we can go forward and be successful. But he added, we'd lose a lot of people, and I think that's unacceptable. So we need to wait. We still need a bit more time. In terms of equipment, not everything has arrived yet. Analysts and Ukrainian officials have hinted for months at a coming Ukrainian counterpunch as the weather improves with various states speculated for its commencement. Of course, Zelensky's remark could be designed to keep the Russians guessing, as both sides are having difficulty with their supplies of ammunition adding to it. Ukraine's receiving Western training as well as advanced weapons for its troops as it gears up such an assault. Later today, UK Defense Secretary Ben Wallace told lawmakers that it sent Ukraine its Storm Shadow missiles. It's a conventionally armed weapon with a range of more than 150 miles. By contrast, truck-mounted HIMAR launchers supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. have GPS-guided missiles capable of hitting targets up to 50 miles away. UK's Ben Wallace said the cruise missiles are now going into are in the country itself, but didn't say how many of them were provided. The air-launched missiles would follow Ukrainian forces to target locations such as Russia-occupied Crimea and perhaps on the eastern front as well. Kyiv has pledged not to use them to attack the country of Russia itself. The U.S. and its allies have expressed concern in the past that enabling Ukraine to use their weapons to hit targets inside Russia could indeed provoke the Kremlin to take more drastic action in this war. The British system adds to the tanks and long-range precision artillery that Western countries have already supplied to boost Ukraine's military. Retired Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, he's a commander of the U.S. Army in Europe, said, "Well done, UK." Well, let's stay in Europe for this next story. Authorities around the world are racing to draw up rules and regulations for artificial intelligence, including in the European Union, where draft legislation faced a pivotal moment today. A European Parliament committee voted to strengthen the flagship legislative proposal as it heads toward passage, part of a years-long effort by Brussels to draw guardrails for artificial intelligence. Those efforts have taken on more urgency as the rapid advances of chatbots like ChatGPT highlight benefits the emerging technology can bring and the new perils it poses. Well, the AI Act, first proposed by the EU in 2021, will govern any product or service that uses an AI system. The Act will classify AI systems according to four levels of risk, from minimal to unacceptable. And of course, riskier applications will face tougher requirements, including being more transparent and using accurate data. Johan Laux, an expert at the Oxford Internet Institute, said to think about it as a risk management system for AI. Now, one of the EU's main goals is to guard against any AI threats to health and safety, as well as protect fundamental civil rights and values. That means some AI uses are an absolute no-no, such as social scoring systems that judge people based on their behavior. AI that exploits vulnerable people like children or that uses subliminal manipulation that can result in harm, like an interactive talking toy that encourages dangerous behavior, is also forbidden under the law. Lawmakers beefed up the proposal by voting to ban policing tools, which crunch data to forecast where crimes will happen and who will commit them. For Tom Cruise. But they also approved a widened ban on facial recognition, say for a few law enforcement exceptions, like preventing a specific terrorist threat. The technology scans passersby and uses AI to match their faces to a database. Brando Benefi, the Italian lawmaker helping to lead European Parliament's AI efforts, said that the aim is to avoid a controlled society based on AI, adding that we think these technologies could be used instead of the good also for the bad, and we consider the risks to be too high. Now, AI systems used in high-risk categories like employment and education, which would affect the course of a person's life, face tough requirements, as they should. They include things like being transparent with users and putting in place risk assessment and mitigation measures. The EU's executive arm says most AI systems, like video games or spam filters, fall into the low or no risk category. The original 108-page proposal barely mentioned chatbots, merely requiring them to be labeled so users know they're interacting with a machine. Well, negotiators later added provisions to cover general purpose artificial intelligence, like ChatGPT. Now subjecting them to some of the same requirements as high-risk systems. One key addition is a requirement to thoroughly document any copyright material used to teach AI systems how to generate text, images, video, or music that resembles human work. Ed Sheeran would be pleased. It would let content creators know if their blog posts, digital books, scientific articles, or pop songs have been used to train algorithms that power systems like Chat LGBT. Then they could decide whether their work has been copied and seek redress. So why are the EU rules so important? I mean, after all, the EU isn't a big player in the cutting-edge technology. That rule's already taken by the U.S. and China. But Brussels does often play a trend-setting role with regulations like these that tend to become de facto global standards. Hey, it's time for another break. Please come back. Dave Allen here. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host, Dave Allen. Melody Cederstrom taking care of clients today. You know where to reach her, though, 1-800-375-4188. Well-known mainstream economist, who we like to occasionally quote on this program, Mohammed L. Orion, says the U.S. has entered the second stage of the banking turmoil, yelling four ways to avoid a significantly more damaging third phase of financial tumult. In an op-ed published yesterday, the chief economic advisor to Alliance stated that the first phase of the turmoil, when depositors fled with their money from poorly managed lenders and caused the string of bank failures, has stabilized. And he was obviously referring to Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and most recently First Republic over the past 2 months. L. Orion also said the current phase, which focuses on funding cost and balance sheet issues of the less problematic banks that happen to operate in a highly unsettled neighborhood, can also be stabilized. Indeed, it must be if we are to avoid a phase entailing considerably more financial and economic damage, unquote. Now, the good news, L. Orion says, is that the U.S. is unlikely to see another dramatic institutional collapse similar to that of Silicon Bank. That may be a bit optimistic, considering the recent study by four professors we talked about in the program the other day, mentioning that one of the four largest U.S. banks could be in serious trouble soon. Well, L. Ryan adds that U.S. regional banks still operate with mismatches between their short-term liabilities and longer-term assets like treasuries. Their balance sheets are further encumbered by dodgy commercial real estate loans, which we also talked about the other day. L. Ryan continued, this second phase can also be contained. First, banks must be careful in what they say. Generally, have been very responsive communicating with investors. Second, the Fed must strengthen its supervision regime. Third, public-private resolutions for banks need to be made to work to a tighter timeline if needed. Fourth, the public sector needs to assure markets that it will work to revamp both the deposit insurance system and the regulation of banks erroneously deemed to involve no systemic threat. Doing so, he warns, is necessary if the U.S. is to avoid a third and significantly more damaging phase of the banking turmoil. In this week's American Survival newsletter, I asked, is PacWest Bank the next to fail? I mean, we still don't know about that, but shares of PacWest were under pressure once again today after the struggling regional bank said that PacWest resumed during the first week of May. The stock was down 23% this morning, further extending its recent declines. Entering the day, PacWest shares had already fallen a net 40% this month and more than 70% since the beginning of the year. The bank said in a securities filing today that its deposit declined 9.5% during the week of May 5th. PacWest said the majority of those outflows came after media reports that said the lender was exploring strategic options, including a sale. The bank also said that it was able to fund those withdrawals with available liquidity. PacWest said it now has $15 billion of that, compared with just $5.2 billion in uninsured deposits. If that's true and the number's correct, the update marks a change from May 4th when PacWest said that it was not experiencing out of the ordinary deposit flows and that total deposit had actually increased since the end of March. During the first quarter, PacWest's total deposits declined 17%, and the bank said it would use, again, these strategic asset sales to reshape it. Several Wall Street analysts theorized that the most recent outflows went from PacWest venture capital customers. An Arfstrom at RBC Capital Markets says that while the deposit news is not what the company wants to report, the outflows are truly from venture depositors and not the core bank. That's actually better news, despite the higher total outflow disclosure. The financial result is that the company is borrowing more to replace those deposits. Now, following PacWest's filing, Western Alliance released its own update and said that its total deposits have grown by $600 million since May 2nd. Shares of that bank were up slightly today. Elsewhere, shares of Zions Bancorp dipped 3.5%, and the Spider S&P Regional Banking ETF was down 1.4%. Regional banking sector continues to be under pressure since early March, when concern about the impact of higher interest rates led to that run on deposits at Silicon Valley, which was seized by regulators, then Signature Bank followed, and then First Republic was seized and sold in the early morning hours to J.P. Morgan Chase before the market opened on May 1st. So, economists, many of them have been forecasting a recession for months. And that looming downturn is one of the most anticipated in U.S. history. But a full-blown recession, anyway, has not yet materialized. It's in large part due to strong consumer spending, which makes up 70% of the economy. Kurt Long at the National Association of Federally Insured Credit Unions says if consumer spending is strong, that alone is, generally speaking, enough to keep the economy from slipping into a recession. Well, in the first quarter this year, GDP grew at a measly 1.1% rate compared to the end of the year. This modest level of growth is an improvement from the mid-2022 GDP figures, which initially brought recession fears to light. Key reason for that fear? Well, inflation was not transitory. It was more persistent than economists initially anticipated. To combat inflation, again, the Fed has hiked its overnight bank lending rate 10 times over the past, 14 months? At the Fed's May meeting, policymakers hinted that they may pause further interest rates in June, barring unexpected developments. The end of this tightening cycle may indeed be coming into focus as consumers reach their breaking point. Now, as the pandemic fades, historic levels of personal saving have taken a nosedive. Deposits at banks have crested as consumers keep spending amid these rising prices. And this is happening to the least well-off. Now, the least well-off are increasingly relying on credit in their day-to-day lives. Almost 30% of households earning less than $50,000 a year are using credit cards to finance their spending. And credit card rates have steadily increased, both the interest rates and the use rates. Moderate income Americans are also facing the significant headwinds of less tax refund money. The average refund this year is under $2,800 so far. It's down 8% from last year. Economist Anna Zhao says because this is the same household that relies on the tax refund to finance their spending, a lower refund really has some negative impact. Analysts at the New York Fed report record levels of credit card debt this year. This is highlighting the economic split in the country, with some consumers still flush with savings after the pandemic, while others finding it increasingly difficult to spend wisely amid rising prices, mounting layoffs, and this coming recession. And still, some economists see a chance for a soft landing. Zhao herself said, "We don't think the slowdown process will be as dramatic as some people have feared." Well, we shall see, Anna. We shall see. Way. The pandemic is over. Today marks the formal end of the national public health emergency that was declared in early 2020. Officially represents the U.S.'s formal emergence from the COVID pandemic. Behind the scenes, several main aspects of the emergency safety net are also coming to a close, too. From extra food assistance and special child tax credits to automatic re-enrollment in Medicaid for health insurance. After 3 years, people are starting to get their jobs back, yes, but it's still not all the way back, and everything is more expensive than before the pandemic was declared. As we try to move on in this new normal, we should remember the words of Radhya Muthiah, president of the Capital Area Food Bank, who said, "The people we serve always seem to be playing catch-up." Yesterday, we're not in the habit here of providing free advertising to our business competitors, but sometimes when they say or write something deserving of mention, well, we're going to tell you about it. James Rickards of the Daily Reckoning writes that most people don't realize there's a way for gold to be used to work around the nation's debt crisis. He calls it the weird gold trick. He says it actually works. Here's now in his own words, quote, when the Treasury took control of all the nation's gold during the Depression under the Gold Reserve Act of 1934, it also took control of the Federal Reserve's gold. But we have a Fifth Amendment that says the government can't seize private property without just compensation. And despite its name, the Federal Reserve is technically not a government institution. So the Treasury gave the Fed gold certificate as compensation under the Fifth Amendment. And to this day, that gold certificate is still in the Fed's balance sheet. Now, fast forward to 1953, when the Eisenhower administration was up against the debt ceiling, and Congress didn't raise the ceiling in time. However, his Treasury secretary realized they couldn't pay the bills, so they turned to the weird gold trick to get the money. It turned out that the gold certificate the Treasury gave the Fed in 1934 did not account for all the gold the Treasury had. It did not account for all the gold in the Treasury's possession. The Treasury calculated the difference, sent the Fed a new certificate for the difference, and said, Fed, show me the money. Well, and the Fed did. The government got the money it needed from the Treasury gold until Congress increased the debt ceiling. Well, that ability exists today. In fact, it exists in a much, much larger form, and here's why. Right now, the Fed's gold certificate values gold at $42.22 an ounce. That's obviously not anywhere near the market price of gold, which is about, well, in the low 2000s. It's at $2,042 an ounce. Recently, it's Tuesday. Now the Treasury could issue the Fed a new gold certificate valuing the 8,000 tons of Treasury gold at $2,042 an ounce. They could take today's market price of $2,042, subtract the official $42.22 price, and multiply the difference by 8,000 tons. That number exceeds $500 billion. In other words, the Treasury could issue the Fed a gold certificate for the 8,000 tons in Fort Knox at $22,042 an ounce and tell the Fed, give us the difference over 42. Voila. Treasury would have over $500 billion out of thin air with no additional debt. It would not add to the debt because Treasury already has the gold. It's just taking an asset and marking it to market. It's not fantasy. It was done twice. It was done in 1934 and again in 1953 by the Eisenhower administration. It could be done again. It doesn't require legislation. Would the government even consider the weird gold trick? Well, Rickard says don't count on it. He believes we shouldn't expect it because no one in power wants to recognize the role of gold as a monetary asset. They don't want anyone to even talk about gold except as the barbarous relic that belongs in the dustbin of history. What instead? Well, he said, expect the game of chicken to continue. Thus, brace yourself for the worst by buying more physical gold, silver too, build up your cash reserves that you can, in Rickard's words, redeploy a later date. Call us for that, 1-800-375-4188. Well, look, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday, which Paul will be here tomorrow to close out the week. And also be on the lookout for our weekly blog in your email inboxes in the AM. Thanks as always to our always on time production engineer Todd Waite, and to you for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Steve Allen. Please be safe out there. Bye bye.